Welcome to this special audio program on investigator perspectives on the development and utilization of oncologic biosimilars and the management of common cancers. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Hope Rugo from the UCSF Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center. And to begin, I asked her to provide a general overview of biosimilars and common questions she receives from oncologists in practice.
So the field of biosimilars, I think, is revolutionizing the treatment of cancer patients worldwide with expensive agents. And these agents, which are biologic agents, are drugs which actually have largely changed the outcome for a variety of different cancers, both in early and late stage setting. And interestingly, biosimilars are also being introduced into the field of rheumatology because that's where antibodies are also being used. So of course we know we've made big progress. We have these targeted agents. What happens when the patent runs out? Well, we're all familiar with the concept of generics. Generics mean, so let's take ibuprofen as an example. You have this little simple chemical, and it's running out of its patent. So a company goes, it takes the chemical structure, which is very easy to analyze for these small molecules, and you take it and you just synthesize that chemical. And then you bind it up with something to make it into a tablet. And there you have your generic agent. What we know about these drugs is that generics can come from all over the world. They have different binders in them. How do they get on the market? Well, you need to show that the chemical structure is identical to the chemical structure of the initial branded product, say ibuprofen. And then you need to show that it's cleared in the same way. So you do a very small study with healthy people, and you show that your pharmacokinetics, the clearance of the drug, is identical, and you're not, you know, having drug hang around or have a different half-life. So very easy. That's why there are so many generics out there, and there are companies which focus on generic drugs. What about a targeted agent, like an antibody? Well, the issue with an antibody is made in a living cell, actually. It's incredibly complex how these are made. And as oncologists, we don't really need to understand how they're all made, but we need to understand why it is that you can't make a generic. So antibodies, we all know that antibodies are big, and the small molecules like ibuprofen are really small. So you've got this really big thing. But that's not the only reason why it needs to be a biosimilar. It's because it's a biologic agent, and agents that are made in living systems have lots of modifications to them. One, for example, modification is the number of sugars that are put on it, or glycosylation. This could affect the clearance of the drug, the activity of the drug. It's very hard to say it's identical because there are so many other things that happen to this other than just making an antibody. And that could also affect the patient making anti-drug antibodies. Like, you can make antibodies against it. So there are a lot of things that could affect it. So actually, the US FDA, the European EMA, the European Medicines Agency, and the World Health Organization, because of the importance of these drugs internationally, all put forth guidelines for how we define a biosimilar and how we could actually get a biosimilar into an approved state so that it could be used in clinical practice. Those guidelines are really important. So the first thing that's part of this is actually showing that through a whole bunch of different studies that are done in the laboratory, that the drug is the proposed biosimilar is relatively similar to the originator product. So for example, trastuzumab biosimilar, it has to be similar to trastuzumab, the originator product, biochemically. And then there are a lot of other tests that are done. For example, you could look at a number of different assays like cytotoxicity, antibody drug cytotoxicity assays, and a whole bunch of other assays looking at the amount of glycosylation, et cetera. As oncologists, I think that we have to trust that all of those assays have been done and have been evaluated very carefully by the regulatory agencies. They usually, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pages of data are submitted to the FDA and reviewed before a drug would actually even go on to the clinical stage of testing. So the next thing that has to happen actually is that you need to know that the drug is cleared normally. And one of the interesting factors has been if the originator product is made in Europe or the United States, you have to show that they're both identical and that they're similar to the proposed biosimilar. So you do studies in healthy people, healthy adults, and you generally show that the drug is cleared. The pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamic assays are similar. So all of that is before we see the drug as practicing oncologists. So the next thing that has to happen is that you have to show that there's clinical similarity. What our regulatory agencies wanted to avoid with these drugs is needing to recreate the entire wheel. So if you were thinking about, say, trastuzumab was tested in metastatic disease, then it moved to early stage disease and neoadjuvant setting. It was given in combination with different chemotherapy drugs, different antibodies, different oral agents. All sorts of different studies have been done with the antibody trastuzumab. So if you were looking at a biosimilar and you needed to reproduce all of those different studies, you would have a drug that, one, took forever to get to market, and two, cost as much, if not more, than the originator product, since it costs more to do everything today than it did 10 or 15 years ago. So if you think about an antibody, and these are the biosimilars of today, or a biologically created agent like filgrastim, we know that they work pretty much the same regardless of their partners or setting. So for example, we know that filgrastim can be given with any kind of chemotherapy treatment that causes low blood counts. It can be given to benign congenital neutropenia. It can be given for radiation-induced neutropenia, and it doesn't have any different effectiveness or toxicity depending on that setting. The same is true of trastuzumab. We know that it's highly effective in the metastatic setting. We know it's highly effective in the adjuvant, neoadjuvant settings, that it works in combination with a whole bunch of different chemotherapy drugs, oral agents, and with different HER2-targeted therapies without any pharmacokinetic or pharmacodynamic concerns. So what that means is the recommendations of the regulatory agencies was that you took a setting where the originator product was highly effective and you could look at a short-term clinical endpoint. If your endpoint was survival, take you forever to get these drugs in. So as long as you've shown all of these other things are true, all of the laboratory studies, your pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics in healthy people, then you go to the clinical setting, you look at a short-term clinical endpoint. And what's fascinating is we've now been able to show that, for example, pathologic complete response in the neoadjuvant setting correlates with an individual patient's outcome, disease-free and overall survival. We've also been able to show for HER2-positive disease that the response rate to your first-line chemotherapy plus trastuzumab correlates with both progression-free survival, and likely overall survival, although we don't have that data yet. So these are really good short-term endpoints. So then you design your trial. Obviously, for a growth factor, your trial will be preventing neutropenia. For an antibody like trastuzumab, your endpoint is going to be response. So that response could be tested in the first-line metastatic setting, or it could be tested in the neoadjuvant setting looking at pathologic complete response. Then you want to show that your progression-free survival is similar. You want to show safety. Safety is identical. And you want to show no antibody drug antibodies, or at least no greater than what you're seeing with the originator product. The duration of observation is variable depending on the drug and the setting that you're testing it in. The questions that people really have are a number of different issues that have come up with the regulatory agencies and where we do have some direction. So one is, you have a short-term endpoint of response. Do I need to wait for overall survival? And the answer to that is no. You want to know that the response rates in the originator product studies correlated with these long-term endpoints, that the population studied was fairly homogeneous, but you don't need to wait for these other endpoints. I will say that for trastuzumab in general, we do have progression-free survival endpoints in the metastatic setting just because of the time it's taken to do the studies. The second thing people ask is whether or not they can extrapolate the use. So, for example, if a drug has been tested in the neoadjuvant or metastatic setting, can you use the drug in all the other settings? And the answer to that is yes. In general, what we understand about the originator product leads us to be confident that we can take these agents and really believe they're as good. That's one of the big comments I get from people. If you have a drug that's available and the study was done in the first-line metastatic setting and it looks identical to trastuzumab, can I give it in the adjuvant setting or neoadjuvant setting? And the answer is yes. The drug actually has approval to be given in all the different settings that you give trastuzumab. Can you use it in gastric cancer? Yes, because it seems as though the activity can be relied upon. So extrapolation is reasonable. The other question that people ask is, can you combine the antibody with other chemotherapy agents and other antibodies? Because we know there's no pharmacokinetic or pharmacodynamic interaction, I feel like it's very reasonable to use these biosimilars in combination with other agents where we know that the originator product has effectiveness. So those are all really important answers. There are pharmacist questions that come up, like, can you do switching? Is there interchangeability, et cetera? For most oncologists, that's not really an issue, and it's an issue which will remain with our pharmacy colleagues in terms of how they use these agents in clinical practice. One of the things that is useful to say is that although we prefer the so-called generic names, these drugs are used as biosimilars. So we have trastuzumab originator, and then we have trastuzumab biosimilar, and the trastuzumab biosimilars are going to have a series of four letters after them, which are meaningless. So until we're actually using them in practice, it's going to be very hard. Although we talk about the names being generic or branded, these are biosimilars, so they'll never be called generic. So it's just an important terminology. So if we talk about trastuzumab originator versus trastuzumab biosimilar, that's probably the easiest way to refer to them without using the branded names.
Yeah, it's really interesting how this is all evolving. Can you talk a little bit about the specific trials and data? And I know you were very involved with this, that were done with the biosimilar to trastuzumab. Can you go through exactly what was done clinically?
Yeah, so the first biosimilar actually studied that led to approval of the first trastuzumab biosimilar in the United States was a study we did in multiple countries, but not in the United States, where there's less reason to use a biosimilar. And what we did was study patients in the first-line metastatic setting, and we allowed the institution to choose the taxane, either docetaxel or paclitaxel. And then the patients were randomized in that first-line HER2-positive setting to receive trastuzumab originator or trastuzumab biosimilar. They then received a set number of weeks, 24 weeks of therapy, and if they had responding or stable disease, they were allowed to continue on the same antibody they started with and drop the chemotherapy, and that was the second part of the analysis. The primary endpoint of that study was overall response rate as a short-term clinically sensitive endpoint. And of course, we had safety and antibody drug antibodies. And then our secondary endpoints were looking at progression-free survival at 48 weeks. So after patients had been on antibody alone for an entire additional 24 weeks. Now, it's true that pertuzumab is now approved and is largely used in combination with trastuzumab based on the CLEOPATRA trial as first-line therapy for HER2-positive breast cancer, but in the majority of the world, pertuzumab is not available, so that these studies were done with trastuzumab alone, and the regulatory agencies wanted them to be done with trastuzumab alone, if possible, to make it as simple as possible. It doesn't, of course, mean that you can't give them in combination, even if you're using a biosimilar. So the other thing that I think is important with this particular trial is because, and it's kind of sobering, is because the trial was done in the rest of world, so to speak, where pertuzumab wasn't available, very few of the patients had ever been exposed to adjuvant trastuzumab. And that's actually really important. It tells you how important this whole field of biosimilars is, that so many people in the world cannot access the originator trastuzumab. And now that the biosimilars are available, for example, in the Philippines at 30 to 40% less than what the cost of the originator is today, that allows many people to be able to afford effective treatment that couldn't before. And I expect that having many biosimilars will result in reduced prices for all of these agents. So we showed that overall response rate at 24 weeks was identical between the two arms. We also showed that safety was the same, and there was a very low rate of anti-drug antibodies, as has been seen with the originator product, and it was identical between the two arms. We also showed that progression-free survival at 48 weeks was identical. And that overall response at 24 weeks correlated very well with progression-free survival at 48 weeks. And we're waiting for our survival data, which should be available, we hope, in the next year. Now, the interesting thing about this particular study is that when people stopped their chemotherapy, we don't really know what happens to most people in that situation, because many trials in the original studies with trastuzumab weren't designed that way. But what we found is actually a small number of patients achieved a partial response or complete response after finishing chemotherapy and continuing on trastuzumab alone, regardless of the arm. Very interesting. And it does suggest there's tremendous benefit for continuing antibody after you stop chemotherapy. And biosimilars will make that more feasible. So that's really good. The other studies that have been done, there's one other metastatic first-line study for which just the top-line data has been presented and shows very similar data to the one I just described. And then there are a number of studies, the largest number of studies, that have been done in the neoadjuvant setting looking at pathologic complete response, giving either trastuzumab originator or trastuzumab biosimilar. All of these studies then offered one or the other of the antibodies to continue for 1 year, as we've done traditionally based on the original adjuvant trials with trastuzumab. One of the studies actually then switched. So after patients had had surgery, they switched to the other. So if you were on trastuzumab originator, you switched to the biosimilar and then the reverse. And of course, they can't show efficacy differences looking at that, but they did show that both agents were safe and that you could switch safely without generating more anti-drug antibodies, which is important. Most of the studies have actually then stopped at 1 year. So they're basically looking at PCR, pathologic complete response, as their primary endpoint, but they aren't then going on for a disease-free survival or overall survival endpoint simply because of the costs required and the number of patients required to really get to that endpoint, showing similarity between the two arms. But one of the studies, one of the largest studies, is continuing on and reconsented patients for longer-term outcome so that they'll look at a 5-year disease-free an overall survival endpoint, which I think will be very helpful, but it's not required for feeling confident in the similarity between the biosimilar and the trastuzumab originator. For the growth factors, of course, the studies have been much easier because you're able to just show that the growth factors prevent neutropenia, that it works throughout the chemotherapy, and then they immediately get into practice. So we already have, because the patent life is already over, we already have actually a biosimilar for filgrastim and another one available soon, or now we use one of them. And then also a pegfilgrastim biosimilar that's been approved and should be available in the near future. The delivery system where you put it on the skin and it's delivered 24 hours later, that's actually still patented. So that won't be available through a biosimilar. That will still be the branded originator for pegfilgrastim. But there will be another pegfilgrastim available as injection the day after chemotherapy, which may be important in many areas.
So right now, what biosimilars are actually available in oncology?
So what we have in oncology is we have filgrastim available. So these are growth factors. Pegfilgrastim has been approved and should be available. Biosimilar bevacizumabs have been approved, but the availability of these agents is not yet in the U.S. So biosimilars for bevacizumab and trastuzumab are available in Europe and are being marketed. But there are a variety of different patent issues for bevacizumab, although the patent has expired for bevacizumab in some situations. So it's thought that bevacizumab will be available in 2019, or I don't know for sure. And trastuzumab, we're hoping, in the later part of 2019. There are already biosimilars available for our rheumatology colleagues, however, so those have already been on the market and are being used. It's interesting that Europe actually had differential patent lives than we have for reasons that are completely unclear to any of us, and so that there are already a number of biosimilars that will be available in Europe and in other countries in the world.
So in terms of using a biosimilar to trastuzumab, based on the data that we have right now, in what situations, if any, would you be comfortable utilizing it?
Well, I think, you know, in the U.S., it's very different from the rest of the world, because in the U.S., we're very much dependent on insurers and what our insurers want us to do. So because these are approved, I think I would feel comfortable using a biosimilar for trastuzumab in any setting in which I use the originator product, providing that that biosimilar has, of course, U.S. FDA approval and has been tested in a rigorous fashion. I think the question is going to be how we extrapolate from different settings. But right now, based on the information we have in our regulatory guidance, I feel very comfortable using a biosimilar. I think that the question is going to be whether or not insurers mandate use of biosimilars. For example, they've been very involved in the filgrastim biosimilar area, trying to get lower cost agents. And how that cost savings is passed on to the consumer, because there's going to be very complicated contracting and supplies that play a role. We don't really know how that's going to shake out yet in the United States, and obviously we're going to find that out over the next year.
You mentioned filgrastim and growth factor support. Are you utilizing that yourself?
Yes, we actually almost always use the biosimilar for filgrastim now because the insurers wanted it and it was easier for us to just have one. And I think that's going to be true in a number of different settings. A lot of times the filgrastim is delivered to patients from a central provider who provides injectables or very expensive drugs like CDK4/6 inhibitors. And they often provide primarily now the biosimilar for filgrastim. So we've adopted it across the board for almost all patients, but for pegfilgrastim, of course, it's not available yet, and we mainly use that deliverable device. So I think that we're probably going to, unless we're forced not to, stick with an on-skin deliverable device because it made such a difference for our patients not to have to pay a share of cost for delivery at home or to have to come in to get the injection.
You were talking before about the clinical data looking at the biosimilar trastuzumab. Could you talk a little bit more, and you sort of referred to the trials that were done with filgrastim. Can you talk a little bit more with a little more granularity about what the trials actually looked at, how many patients were in them?
Well, I can tell you that the trials that looked at filgrastim as a biosimilar versus the originator product were very straightforward, you know, primarily looking at the endpoint after the first cycle of chemotherapy, choosing a chemotherapy regimen that had a high rate of expected febrile neutropenia, but primarily really looking at nadir counts because it's really a much easier endpoint than looking at a disease-specific therapeutic. And then, of course, they had looked over time, but it was these are very short endpoint studies. And enrolled a few hundred patients, similar to what the biosimilars for trastuzumab have done, rather than thousands of patients. And the amount of data for the biosimilar is, of course, very small and fits into the most sensitive endpoint, you know, a few hundred patients.
So what about rituximab? What's going on with that?
Well, there are different biosimilar studies that have been done for rituximab, and some have tried to have too much extrapolation or not enough safety data. And, you know, there are two things that people really fear. One is being inferior or having worse pharmacokinetics or antibody-drug antibodies, and the other is being superior, right? You don't want to be a bio-better because you want to show that you're the same drug. So those are the kinds of things that can be involved. And sometimes it's not just being turned down. For example, it could be that right now the approval is turned down, but they want to go in. You know, they go in and do this huge amount of effort for approval, including doing an on-site inspection of the production facility. So a lot of times it has to do with the production facility or trying to verify the data. So there's a number of different issues where approval for a biosimilar could be delayed.
Any myths or misperceptions about biosimilars in oncologists? Any questions that you get from them about it?
Well, I think that one really important one is that not all studies are equal. So, for example, there are biosimilars around the rest of the world, not in the U.S. and will never be in the U.S., where 120 patients were studied with a short-term endpoint, primarily looking at safety. And that does not fulfill the regulatory guidelines. So it's really important to keep that in mind when you're thinking about what you're talking to someone about who comes from another part of the world, for example. We're unlikely to really face those issues in the United States, which is important, or in Europe, because the EMA is very careful about approval, similar to the US. They have very similar guidelines for approval of proposed biosimilars. The other myth is that you can't extrapolate and that you need to wait for the long-term endpoints. And I think it's really important to understand why that isn't important. And I think, you know, graphically, if you really look at the studies with trastuzumab and show the lack of interaction when given with pertuzumab, and it helps you to believe that if you have a drug that's truly a biosimilar, that you could extrapolate to different settings with impunity. You don't have to worry too much about extrapolating, and that you're doing your patient a disservice by using these drugs in the early stage curable setting when we've shown that they have identical clinical efficacy as the originator product.
Anything else that we haven't talked about in terms of this topic that you want to bring up?
I think one thing that comes up for some people is the issue about the patent life and why it is we don't have biosimilars yet. And this is a very complicated area. And it's interesting, actually, even when drugs get approval, that it can take a while to work its way through various agreements that have been made about distributing the drug that are extremely complex. And it has been the whole study of biosimilars and working in this area that has helped me to understand exactly how complex that really is. So, you know, on our side, on the physician's side, we can't really impact that. So we just have to support the use of agents when we believe them to be fitting the criteria set forth by our regulatory agencies. The other thing that I think that's really important is this pharmacologic monitoring for safety. The regulatory agencies have realized that with short-term endpoints, we need longer-term follow-up for safety. Now, one of the things, of course, that's nice is that because of the fact that the trials were done earlier than the patent expiration in the United States, we'll actually have quite a lot of longer-term safety data, particularly in our metastatic trial where patients are staying on until progression. But it's important to keep in mind that you are obliged by the regulatory agencies to report toxicities through the FDA, regardless of whether or not you're using the originator or biosimilar product. And when these drugs are available on the market, the reporting will be clear. And it doesn't just hold true for the biosimilars. It's true for the originator product as well. And your pharmacist will play a really important role in reporting these toxicities.
Are you saying that because the biosimilar is available, there's going to be a different reporting for the parent drug?
No, the reporting will be the same, but it's just really pharmacovigilance that's important. And it's true for any new approved drug. But I think that, you know, there's been an emphasis on the reporting in terms of pharmacovigilance for the biosimilars as they go into the marketplace so that we're sure we're tracking any potential toxicities over time as the number of patients who are exposed to these drugs increases.